Welcome to Food for Thought, the place to explore, celebrate, and manifest a life motivated and defined by unconditional compassion and optimal wellness. Today's episode is Advent, fasting, and abstaining from meat. Before we begin, my name is Colleen Patrick-Goudreau. I'm your host. You can find me at joyfulvegan.com. If you're interested in vegan travel, you can check out joyfulvegantrips.com. This podcast is possible because of the support of listeners like you. There are no sponsors or ads on Food for Thought, and with your help, we can keep that up. If that's something you value, please join other supporters by going to patreon.com/ColleenPatrickGoudreau to become a supporter today at your chosen level. Thank you so much in advance for supporting, for subscribing, and for listening. I suppose it's not considered subscribing anymore because I listen to podcasts and it looks like now it's following podcasts, not subscribing. So I hope you follow this podcast. I hope you're doing fabulously well. I'm going to tell you right now, this time of year just makes me giddy with excitement, especially because living in California, we are now, I think, officially out of, we're not out of the drought, but we're officially out of the fire season, which is always a relief. And it's been raining. I think we're officially in the rainy season. The ground is wet. The light this time of year is low and golden and beautiful. We are at the peak of our foliage this time of year. And the air just smells so sweet and so fresh. I'm just giddy every day. We're leaving soon for Rwanda. And we'll be there, we'll be in Africa for a month because we will be in South Africa also. We're scouting the garden route, and we are hosting our other African joyful vegan trip in Botswana and starting in Cape Town. So we'll be in Rwanda, then South Africa, then Botswana. And I'm very excited about these trips that we're hosting, and of course, the trip that we're scouting. But I'm so sad we're leaving this area because I love this time of year here. But we will be back before Christmas, and I can't wait to share more about that with you because I kind of geek out around this time of year, and I'm glad we're going to be home for Christmas. I really love this time of year. And so this is an episode that's related to that. I have been wanting to do this episode for years. You could say this has been years in the making because I've been gathering information and I've been doing research and I've been asking questions for years on this topic. And I'm really thrilled to share it with you finally, especially as we approach the Christmas holidays. I talk a lot about how being vegan can make you, some people, and people around you feel that by virtue of you being vegan, you're no longer aligned with traditions or religion or culture, any of the things that you may have grown up with or had close ties to. It could just be the family that you grew up in. People can perceive being vegan as being antithetical to any and all of these things. I write in the Joyful Vegan quote, I'm quoting myself, because our identity is relative to the social groups to which we belong. When we feel isolated from these groups, it can rock us to our core, altering how we see ourselves and how we relate to others. When our existing identities rooted in family, culture, religion, politics, or gender collide with our vegan identity, we experience a great deal of conflict, both interpersonal and intrapersonal, and may feel compelled to choose one over the other. This conflict often serves as a justification for making no change at all or for returning to eating meat, dairy, and eggs. I hear from people all the time, I'm now leaving the quote, where people say, my background is German, I could never be vegetarian or vegan. I'm Jewish, I could never be vegan. I'm Irish, I'm German, I'm Greek, whatever. I said German, but whatever it is, right? There's this perception that being vegan is incongruent with being name it. there isn't one cultural or religious group I haven't heard cited as one whose food traditions are antithetical to being vegan, especially when it comes to the holidays, when we're supposed to be feasting and indulging. And why would you want to deprive yourself of all the good things in life? And yet, historically, abstaining from animal flesh and fluids has been a tradition for centuries in most religions. In fact, I would venture to say, I'm going to say it. Historically, there would have been more days throughout the calendar year when people were not eating animal flesh and fluids than when they were. The regular, and let's be honest, daily consumption of animal flesh and fluids is a relatively modern practice. It's pretty contemporary. It's made possible only because of industrial factory farming. But abstaining from animal flesh and fluids, especially as part of religious observances, was more common, was a regular part of the calendar, especially the liturgical calendar. In this case, I'm talking about Christianity. We even have common words in the English language that reflect and support this, and I can't wait to share those with you. Now, I'm not a historian of religion in general or Christianity in particular, but I do have my own experience and I do possess a healthy amount of curiosity that leads me to ask questions about this topic, in particular, veganism, food, traditions, abstention from meat, animals, etc., right? And so it's through the lens of my experience and my curiosity and subsequent findings that I want to unpack this with you. I grew up in a mixed religious household. My father was Catholic and my mother was Protestant. And while that might not seem like a very dramatic contrast, both being Christian religions, it definitely caused tension and strain in my family, and the religion of each of my parents affected me in profound ways, ways that cannot be separated from who I became and who I am. My father came from a long line of Irish Catholics, and it was, and it still is, a huge part of my father's identity. You've heard me talk about my mother a lot in the past and her death in 2020. But I have a father as well, who I don't talk about as much. He's alive and he's in Florida and he's declining in health, but he will be 91 this January 2023. His mother died just months short of her 100th birthday. So who knows how long my father will be around. I was out to visit him a couple times this past year. And since the last time I was there, he's had a priest come to his house to give him his last rites, which, if you're not familiar with them, they're the last prayers, the final prayers and blessings a person receives from a priest that provides spiritual comfort and renewed faith that they will meet their maker. So when I say that religion is a huge part of his identity, I mean it. And he wanted it to be a huge part of mine and my sister's as well. And so it was agreed between my mother and my father that we would be raised Catholic. And so we were. And we attended Catholic school, at least until I was 10 and my sister was 12, which is when our parents were divorced and we moved to a new town with our mother, where we attended public schools, and we would continue to do so for the rest of our schooling. But to say that Catholicism played a huge role in my upbringing would be an understatement. My father attended church every day. He was friendly with all of the clergy in our church and in our school, the nuns and the priests and the deacons. We went to Mass every Sunday. We went to catechism every week. catechism is essentially instruction in the classroom, classroom instruction in Catholicism to prepare you for your first communion and confirmation and other sacraments. And indeed, we went to confession. We went through the rite of first communion and confirmation. And it was a huge part of our lives. And my mother agreed to all of this. I don't think she had much choice, but she agreed to all of this. But it must be said that her being Protestant and a divorced Protestant at that was not something we were ever able to forget, because for the offense of marrying a divorced, bad enough, Protestant, even worse, woman, my Catholic father made some kind of bargain when he married my mother in 1967, whereby he would not take communion or go to confession for the rest of his life as his self-inflicted penance for marrying my mother. So every time we went to church, and that was all the time, he wouldn't go to communion when we would. And this was his self-inflicted penance. My mother was married, for context, my mother was married for 10 years to a man she had no children with before she met my father. But for the last few years of her marriage, she was having an affair with my father. And so she left Don for my father. And it always struck me as odd that my mother being Protestant and divorced was the reason my father struck this bargain with God. Not that he was pursuing a married woman, which seems that that would be a sin. So I have a complicated history with my family and my parents, but it's colorful and it provides great stories. So I think that was part of it. I think my father did. I think now still he obsesses over the fact that he pursued a married woman, but that's not what was communicated to me. What was communicated to me when we were growing up was that my mother was a divorced Protestant. And for that, my father sacrificed going to confession and going to communion. That's what my understanding was. And when it came time to forge my own beliefs, my mother's Protestantism was a refuge for me. And I eventually did break away from my father's religion, which caused a permanent upset for him. And like most children, like most offspring who go through the necessary process of finding their own way after having been raised in a different way, I threw the baby out with the bathwater. I rejected and criticized and judged the religion I was brought up in. I did that for years. But as I continued to get older and wiser, I didn't want to have an attitude of arrogance. I didn't want to reject outright something that had been a huge part of my life, in the sense that I didn't want to have this, I don't know, identity of being this recovering Catholic, right? I mean, I just didn't want that to be my orientation. And so I made a conscious effort to reconcile my past and reframe and reshape and reform my memories to find not just peace with the Catholicism I grew up in. I talked to my husband, who also grew up Catholic. He had a different experience. So, you know, I have my own very specific familial experience in Catholicism. It's not the same experience that everybody has, but I wanted to find peace with that, but I also wanted to find an appreciation for some of the rites and the rituals that it was centered on. And I did that. And I have some things I can look back on and say, I really appreciated that. I really liked that. I really can embrace that. And actually, rites and rituals are one of the things I appreciate most about the religion I grew up in. And of course, rites and rituals are not specific to Catholicism or to religion, but they're an aspect of it that I can appreciate, that I looked back on and then I said, I could appreciate that, I can embrace that. And I've talked about secular rites and rituals that I partake in my life. I think most of us, I think we all do. We probably don't even call them rituals. And I hold them very dear. And so I remember with great fondness the rites and rituals surrounding many holidays that we celebrated growing up, especially Easter and Christmas, and the corresponding periods leading up to them, namely and respectively Lent and Advent. Now, as you know, I grew up eating animal products, but even when I was a child, I was aware of the historical tradition of fasting and abstaining from meat during these periods. So over the years, I've thought about this a lot, and this is why I've been wanting to cover this on this podcast for so long, because I'm very interested in the history of and the meaning of not just fasting. I mean, that's a whole other conversation about what fasting has meant historically and in religion, but really abstaining from meat. That's what I've been obviously very interested in. And so here we are approaching the Christmas holiday and its preceding Advent season, both of which always spark in me memories of the traditions and rites and rituals I experienced throughout my childhood, and also spark in me a curiosity about and an awareness of the food traditions that surround these holidays. Now, many of you, Christian or not, would be familiar with Lent, the 40 days before Easter Sunday. So it's the 40 days between Ash Wednesday and Easter Sunday. And it's a time devoted to fasting and repentance and contrition and penitence. And also for my listeners who didn't grow up Catholic, Ash Wednesday is the first day of Lent, and it's named for the practice of Christians of placing ashes on their heads as a sign of contrition. And so Lent starts on Ash Wednesday. And then as you get closer to Easter itself, Good Friday is the day of the crucifixion. That's the Friday before Easter Sunday. And being Catholic, we were expected to give something up for Lent. And I loved this tradition. I did love this tradition. And I'll talk a little bit more later about why I loved that tradition so much. But the idea is that you would give something up for Lent for 40 days, at the end of which, on Easter, you celebrate and you eat and you consume and you feast. And all of that sacrifice leads up to the celebration. That's the point. You sacrifice, and then there's a feast, right? And you can see that even in the language we use today, in the language we have for these holidays. Lent begins with Mardi Gras. It's French for Fat Tuesday, because you would be eating the last amount of fat before the fast that begins the next day on Ash Wednesday and goes up until the Easter feast. It goes right up until Holy Saturday is what it would be called, and then the Easter feast. The other name for Mardi Gras is Carnival, which comes from the Latin root carne, meaning meat, meaning flesh, and Latin lavare, meaning to remove. So carnival literally means removing meat, referring to the coming 40 days when animal flesh was abstained from during Lent, for the entire duration of Lent. Now, in the Byzantine tradition, still practiced by Orthodox Christians, meat wasn't the only thing that was abstained from during Lent. All animal products were and are. And that can be seen in another word that marks the beginning of Lent. It's not a word that you'd be very familiar with if you weren't practicing, but that is Cheese Fair Sunday. And that's the Sunday before Ash Wednesday. Cheese Fair, like F-A-R-E as in farewell, because literally Cheese Fair meant farewell to cheese, farewell to dairy products for the duration of the Holy Fast. And the Sunday before that is Meat Fair. I was going to say is Meat Fair Sunday, indicating a farewell to meat in the diet. So you've got Fat Tuesday, which is mostly about fat, but fat also includes animal fat. You've got Carnival, farewell to meat, removing meat. Cheese Fair, farewell to dairy products. And Meat Fair Sunday, indicating a farewell to animal flesh in the diet for the duration of that period of Lent. And so here we are now as I record this approaching Advent season, which, like Lent, led up to the great feast of Christmas. So Lent leads up to Easter, Advent leads up to the feast of Christmas. And even though Christmas celebrates the birth of Christ, Easter is the holier of the two and the festival upon which Christianity really hangs its hat. But in the past, especially in the Middle Ages in Europe, Advent was a big deal, a much bigger deal than it is today. And I can say that because even though it wasn't that long ago when I was little, I mean, like maybe 50 years is a long time ago, but not when we're comparing it to 2,000 years of history. So 40 years ago when I was 10, Advent just even then wasn't as big a deal as it was centuries before that. And centuries leading up to that. For me, growing up, Advent was special. Indeed, it was special in that it anticipated Christmas. There's this excitement that is palpable during Advent because it's like this excitement like leading up to Christmas. And much wasn't asked of us like it was asked of us during Lent. We didn't have to give something up. That's not my memory of Advent in my upbringing. In fact, what I remember most about Advent in our house, and this is something that's still practiced today, you've probably heard of an Advent calendar. I loved the Advent calendar so much because you have these calendars. You know, I know there's so many different calendars today. There's like, we'll get to that. But my calendar, where there were simple calendars, they were basically little, you know, cutouts, like you'd open little doors and behind the little door would be an image. It'd be an image of something that related to the story of Christmas. So there would be an image of the Star of Bethlehem. There'd be an image of a donkey Mary was riding on. There would be a stable of animals. So you can imagine, as a little girl, as an animal lover, I did open up those little windows. There'd be a donkey and I'd be so excited. There'd be a stable of animals. I'd be so excited. I loved the Advent calendar. And I just, because it just created this anticipation. Today, there are different kinds of calendars. There's like calendars where you can get like a piece of chocolate or candy behind each day leading up to Christmas. But that is not how Advent was observed historically, like the opposite. Advent, like Lent, was a time for prayer and reflection and penitence and fasting and abstinence, not a period where you would get treats every day leading up to more treats on Christmas Day. It's just not how it worked. The Advent observances in the Middle Ages, again, for example, were every bit as strict as Lent, and meat was forbidden during that period as well. In Advent, the equivalent last feast before abstaining, again, the last feast in Lent was Fat Tuesday. The equivalent last feast during Advent, or approaching Advent, was called St. Martin's Feast Day. The idea, again, being that you have this feast before you fast, right? And it was traditionally centered around eating animal flesh, particularly geese in the case of Advent. You'd eat lots of fat, lots of meat, lots of butter. And then the days leading up to Christmas were days of prayer and reflection and abstaining from animal flesh. And this goes back to the beginning of the Christian church. Abstinence from flesh, from animal flesh, is one of the oldest Christian traditions from the first century. The day of the crucifixion has been traditionally observed as a day of abstaining from flesh. The ancient form of Christian fasting was called a black fast. And those undertaking a black fast consumed no food during the day, although sometimes water was permitted. And then they would break the fast. That's literally where we get the word from, after sunset with prayer, and then they would have a meal devoid of meat, devoid of eggs, devoid of dairy products, devoid of alcohol as well. Now, traditions varied in different parts of Europe as time went on, depending on the location, but giving up meat was common. And in many places, all animal products were strictly forbidden during Advent and Lent. Now, there were regional differences about the rest of the details. Most areas permitted fish. Others permitted fish and fowl, chickens. Some prohibited fruit. Some prohibited eggs. Some places, like monasteries, ate little more than bread during this period. In some places, on Fridays during Lent and Advent, believers abstained from food for an entire day, all food. Others took only one meal. In most places, however, the practice was to abstain from eating until the evening, when a small meal would be eaten again, without meat, without alcohol. Now, as I said, the traditions varied in different parts of Europe, but the Eastern Christian Church, one of the oldest, has always been and continues to be the most rigorous in terms of abstaining from meat and animal products as part of religious observance. The Ethiopian Orthodox Church, for example, has 250 fasting days, 180 of which are obligatory for lay people, not just monks and priests. And they follow a calendar similar to the Eastern Catholic Church and the Coptic Church, which both of which, all of which, call for essentially a vegan fast for the 40 days prior to Christmas, including Christmas, including December 25th, typically prohibiting meat, dairy, eggs, oil, and wine. Now, some traditions are ambiguous about whether fish may be eaten, and we see that across the board. This is one of the reasons Ethiopian cuisine is so vegan friendly, because their cuisine reflects their religion. Now, ironically, though, in the past, even if fish was permitted, meat and animal products were much less available to your average churchgoer, and yet they were asked to give all of this up as part of the holy ritual, as a form of penitence. Today, meat consumption is a daily habit, 3 or more times a day. And yet the notion of giving it up for a day, never mind 40 days, is abhorrent to most people. And the church rules reflect that. Today, if you're a practicing Christian, it's unlikely your church will ask you to fast for 40 days, or I should say this, abstain from meat for 40 days before Christmas, during Advent. Now, canon law has changed over the centuries, kind of reflecting modern tastes. I mean, I'm saying modern, and this has changed over the centuries. But essentially what has happened is the call for abstaining from meat has been watered down. And what is required of parishioners is really not that much, right? And now all manner of meat eating during the holy holidays is allowed, as well as the days leading up to it. When my father was growing up, they didn't eat meat on Fridays at all. No, they didn't eat meat. They didn't have money for meat. But traditionally, meat was abstained from in the Catholic Church by Catholic parishioners on every Friday. Now, again, for those who are curious and who didn't grow up in a Catholic home, Friday has always been a day of penance for Christians, because by the standards of the religion, Jesus died on Friday. And Sunday has always been a holy day because Jesus rose on a Sunday. So every Sunday is like a mini Easter season, right? Every Friday is like a mini Lent in preparation for Sunday. By the time I was growing up, I do remember Fish Fridays. The idea that you couldn't eat meat, I'm saying meat to distinguish it from fish, because that's the language that you'll find is used, but land animals, put it that way, like you couldn't eat land animals on Fridays, but you could eat aquatic animals on Fridays. And that's what's considered Fish Fridays, right? And we continued that during Lent and Advent. Fish Fridays is still a thing, right? But what? Big sacrifice, right? Big sacrifice. Like we couldn't eat, like, you know, we could eat meat every day, but like on Fridays, you can't eat meat, but you can eat fish. Like there's not a lot of sacrifice there. And I think this is one of the reasons, this idea is one of the reasons I think the general population doesn't associate fish as meat, right? Like the idea that you can say that you're vegetarian, but still eat fish, and people really wouldn't look at you funny. And I think it comes from this idea that in many religions call for the abstinence from animal flesh for different holidays and different observances, but allow for the consumption of fish. And fish, when you look at the rules in a lot of different religions, tends to be grouped with vegetables as acceptable to eat during fasting or during abstinence from quote-unquote meat. I think also in former times, animal flesh from land animals was more expensive. It always has been. You've heard me talk about this before, this idea that somehow being vegan is more expensive than eating animal is ridiculous, because land animals, it's always been more expensive. It has always been a source of luxury to consume, especially land animals. So land animals were more expensive. They were eaten only occasionally. They were associated with feast days. The truth is, fish was cheaper. Most people could go and, you know, if you were near the sea, you could fish. And it was cheaper. It was more widely available, more widely accessible. It was eaten more often. It was not associated with celebrations. And so I think this is where that idea stems from, that fish don't belong in the flesh meat category. I'm not saying that I think people all believe that they belong in the vegetable category, but I think that's where that stems from. Just my theory. I'm not saying that, you know, the majority of people who think that are Christian or religious, but I think that's just penetrated the general consciousness. Just my thought. Love to hear yours. So technically, abstaining from meat on Fridays and being allowed to have fish is the universal law of the Catholic Church, Roman Church, Eastern Church, Orthodox Church, right? The abstinence in Eastern and Orthodox churches, however, also includes Wednesdays. And their abstinence excludes fish. Like when you're abstaining from meat, you're also abstaining from fish. You're also abstaining from dairy and other animal products, like pretty much vegan. By the 9th century, the strict rules about fasting and abstaining from animal products in Western Christianity started to become more relaxed, and even more so over the centuries. Abstinence from meat on Fridays was never technically abolished from Roman Catholic law. For instance, Canon Law 1251 says abstinence from meat or from some other food as determined by the Episcopal Conference is to be observed on all Fridays. Abstinence is to be observed on Ash Wednesday and Good Friday. But this has been relaxed quite a bit. Many national bishops' conferences, including the U.S. bishops, make exceptions in their jurisdictions, permitting Catholics to choose another form of penance instead. In 1966, and this is kind of where we're at today, the National Conference of Catholic Bishops issued a pastoral statement on penance and abstinence, in which they declared, among other things, quote, "Among the works of voluntary self-denial and personal penance, which we especially commend to our people for the future observance of Friday, even though we hereby terminate the traditional law of abstinence as the sole prescribed means of observing Friday, we give first place to abstinence from flesh meat. We do so in the hope that the Catholic community will ordinarily continue to abstain from meat by free choice, as formerly we did in obedience to church law." So as you can hear in the language, the bar has been lowered, and the bishops hope the community will abstain from meat on Fridays. So essentially, the rule was transformed into a hope, because, you know, you don't want people to have to forego the consumption of animal flesh for one day. So abstaining from meat is essentially left up to the individual churchgoer, or, you know, perhaps the jurisdiction you're in, if you're, you know, the bishop is calling for it where you are. But it really has relaxed a lot. And over time, as rules about abstaining from meat were relaxed, so too were the definitions of, you know, which animal's flesh constitutes meat. So we talked about fish, right? But we also have, like, amphibians, cold-blooded animals, frogs, clams, turtles, they are permitted to be eaten even during the times when parishioners are called upon to abstain from meat. And it's a question that you continually see during these periods where people are called upon to not eat animal flesh. Like, they're like, can we have clams? Can we have lobster? Can we have penguin? And like, seriously, the church issues exceptions. Like, beaver and muskrat are allowed, even though, I mean, I'm not kidding. Like, can we raise the bar a little more than we do? That's my problem. It's not just Catholicism. This is nothing, like, this is not specific to Christianity. This is just, we keep the bar so low. And this is an example of that. Now, when it comes to Advent, in the 6th century, church councils began requiring fasting on all days throughout Advent, like 40 days from St. Martin's Day, which is November 11th, to Epiphany, which is January 6th. And we're going to come back to Epiphany and Twelfth Night and the 12 days of Christmas and all that. But today, few Christians outside of Eastern Orthodox churches observe Advent as a time of abstinence. On the contrary, in the West, especially, the holiday season really begins, begins at Thanksgiving, probably begins at Halloween, to be honest, but it really has become one giant feast, starting at Thanksgiving and going to Christmas. And it's interesting because if you now understand, and now you do, that the Advent season begins November 11th, right? St. Martin's Day. The Thanksgiving that we celebrate today, what we call Thanksgiving today, as you can see, it falls within that period, that Advent period, that most people aren't celebrating again unless you're in the Orthodox Church. But the point is, at the time when Sarah Josepha Hale, for instance, was urging President Lincoln to make Thanksgiving a national holiday, it wasn't to make a national holiday to just have feasting and, you know, indulgence. Even in 1865, it was a time of prayer and penitence and reflection. It wasn't this kind of indulgent feasting that we have today, but that's where we are today. Today, you know, this kind of feasting starts at Thanksgiving and it goes all the way to Christmas. And that's one of the reasons where it's so interesting that people say, oh, you're vegan. Like, you're just missing out on what this holiday is all about. And it's like, well, what's this holiday about? Because we all attribute our own meaning to these holidays, right? Today and over time. And historically, these holidays have been about mostly prayer and abstinence, not over-the-top indulgence and consumption. Now, I'm not saying feasting is a bad thing in and of itself. I certainly partake in my share. But if the point of a feast is that you're coming off of a fast, then feasting without having had any kind of abstinence prior to it kind of misses the point, doesn't it? Like, my understanding is, especially when it's done for spiritual purposes, that the discipline of fasting, when practiced with prayer and repentance and almsgiving and charitable deeds, that kind of thing, it orients us away from worldly desires and more towards spiritual desires. I mean, that's the whole idea, right? Now, I'm not Christian, I'm not Catholic, and I personally don't partake in any religious ritual fasts, but I do appreciate the concept of giving something up for a period of time. This is one of the things I loved when I was young. I loved the idea of being given the opportunity to demonstrate self-control, to demonstrate discipline, even sacrifice. I think that word is so loaded, but that idea that we sacrifice something, that we give something up, that leads up to a celebration where we get to partake in the thing that we gave up. Like, that's, there's something really, I don't know, something really interesting and special there, I think. And it's not lost on me that during that time of abstinence or sacrifice, it is about self-reflection. It is about prayer and meditation and contemplation and simplicity, right? You don't have to be religious to appreciate that or partake in it. And I've been incorporating this more into our holiday seasons because I find it really rewarding and fortifying, gratifying. There's something really gratifying about self-denial, right? Now, I'm vegan already, so animal flesh and fluids are things that I've already turned away from. But there are certainly indulgences that I enjoy that would and are absolutely considered an effort to not consume for any length of time. Could be, I'll speak for myself, could be wine, could be bread, could be chocolate, could be sugar, whatever it is that we have access to all the time that not having for any length of time is an effort or a sacrifice, right? Or discipline. So for the last couple of years, I have been challenging my poor husband. He has to partake in all of the schemes I come up with, but I've been challenging David and myself to give something up between Thanksgiving and Christmas so that by the time Christmas comes along, it feels like a treat and it's been really rewarding. Now, when researching this episode, I came across a really interesting article that asked the question, if plant-based meat was considered meat for those who are asked to give it up during Lent and Advent. And at first my reaction was like, oh my Lord, that's ridiculous. Like, of course, people abstaining from animal flesh should be permitted to eat the Impossible Burger, right? I mean, seitan was essentially invented by Buddhist monks who were vegetarian. They weren't eating animal flesh as part of their religion, but they still wanted something similar in texture, hence mock duck. It started in China thousands of years ago, right? And the truth is, eating animal flesh is a daily ritual for most people. So having a Beyond sausage is making a better choice, a healthier choice, right? But then I found myself thinking, well, I'm always promoting the idea that this stuff is meat. It's plant-based meat. I want to call it meat, right? But it's meat. And so maybe it should be included under the meat that churchgoers are asked to abstain from. Someone in the article I was reading pointed out that abstaining from meat is also meant to be tied to almsgiving or donating to charity. So the idea that you're supposed to like give people in need whatever money you would save by not buying meat, again, animal flesh, during Lent. Like, that's the idea. And so if a plant-based burger costs as much or more than a meat-based, an animal-based burger, then the charitable part of the tradition is missing. Sure, you could frame it that way. But in the end, I would say this, and I'm going to say it, that in having plant-based burgers, plant-based meat, you are abstaining from animal flesh. And my God, if fish can be considered plants, then plants should be considered plants, right? Plants should count as plants to be consumed during the fasting holidays, the holidays that call for abstention, abstaining from meat, from animal flesh. Even if the plants resemble the texture and taste of animal flesh, they are still plants and they do not come with the high costs in all the ways we can quantify costs as animal flesh does. But I would say that the idea of abstaining from animal flesh is that it's about denying yourself something that you would normally have but are willing to give up for higher purposes, which means if you're already vegan, then yeah, perhaps maybe focus on more simple meals, maybe more simple than you normally have. If you eat out a lot, perhaps make the commitment to eat at home for 40 days. If you eat a lot of convenience or packaged foods, eat only whole foods for 40 days. If you eat a lot of plant-based meats, maybe focus on peanut butter and jelly and other simple dishes for 40 days. If you're vegetarian, try being vegan for 40 days. If you're still eating animal flesh and fluids, try being vegan for 40 days, right? Now I'm saying 40 days because 40 days of Advent, November 11th to January 6th, but that's not really observed by most Western Christians these days. Typically, Advent today begins on the fourth Sunday before December 25th. So I'm saying 40 days, but really we're talking about 4 weeks. And that's the point, is to stretch our comfort zones, right? To sacrifice a little in the hopes of living more intentionally, more simply, more consciously, more deeply. It's one of the reasons we see so many people give up meat. I mean, I see a lot of people take my 30-day vegan challenge. around Lent, more than normal. It's mostly Lent. It's not necessarily Advent, because Lent is really a time most people associate with giving up something. It usually is meat, because most people eat meat every day. And so it is a sacrifice. And so it's a real opportunity for those of us who are advocates. We can remind our Christian friends and family members of the opportunity to give up animal flesh even during Advent. Now, remember, historically, the fast of Advent, this period, went from November 11th to January 6th. Typically, it's about 30 days before Christmas, as I mentioned, four Sundays, 4 weeks, right? And Christmas itself, December 25th, is the big feast. But historically, in the Middle Ages, during the Tudor Age, Christmas was indeed the end of the fasting, the end of the abstinence, and the beginning of the revelry, at which time you begin the 12 decadent days of feasting and singing and general carousing, culminating in Twelfth Night or Epiphany. That's what the 12 days of Christmas are. It's lost on, I think, modern folks, because there's this idea, it's not the 12 days leading up to Christmas, it's the 12 days starting on Christmas. On the first day of Christmas, my true love gave to, like, that's the first day of Christmas. It's the 12 days of Christmas. And it's all about the decadence and consumption, starting on December 25th, having abstained, or at least lived more simply for the days leading up to Christmas, and ending on January 6th, which is the Epiphany, which is when the three kings, or the three wise men, visited Jesus in his manger and brought him gifts, the gold, the frankincense, the myrrh, and all of that. That's what the 12 days of Christmas are. And even though we've been talking about fasting, and we're going to come back to that, by the way, I'm going to do an entire episode on the foods of the 12 days of Christmas, vegan style, of course. But we've been talking about fasting being a tradition during the Advent season, historically speaking. And I'm using that term loosely and interchangeably with abstaining from meat. Most lay people did not fast, i.e. abstain from food completely during the period, the fasting period. It would mostly be abstaining from meat. But there were saints' feast days during that period, because people were still eating food, but they were simple foods. They were more simple foods, and they were foods that celebrated the different saints. That's what feast days are, the saints' days are. And we still eat these foods today. We have many wonderful traditional foods that come from the season of Advent, some of which you probably make. Number one is the St. Lucia buns, also called Lucicotter. St. Lucy's Day, St. Lucia, is December 13th. And I have a recipe for St. Lucia buns at joyfulvegan.com. And I really encourage you to go over and get that recipe, make that recipe. It is so fantastic. It's a Swedish favorite at Christmas time. These are saffron-infused buns, and they are they're buttery, they're slightly sweet, they have this gorgeous, vibrant yellow, they are S-shaped sometimes they're shaped in the form of a ram's head, I should say, and they're wonderful. So that is a traditional food during the Advent season, December 13th being St. Lucy's Day. You also have something called Speculoos. They're Dutch cookies for St. Nicholas's Day, which is December 6th. And you would also have mulled wine or bishop's wine, which is drunk also on St. Nicholas Day. On December 12th, it's the Our Lady of Guadalupe, and Mexican food would be really appropriate. So making the Mexican wedding cakes, or the Russian tea balls, they're also called. I have those in my Joy of Vegan Baking. They're perfect. The little sugar cookies that are made from ground almonds covered in powdered sugar. You can also make a Mexican chocolate cake. These would all be appropriate during the Advent holiday. And then on December 24th, you'd have star cookies, like starlight cookies, because that's just representing the Star of Bethlehem, and that's just before Christmas. Now, you also have something called Stollen. If you're in Europe, you're probably familiar with this, especially if you're in Germany, you would be familiar with this, or any Germanic countries. Now, Stollen, this is Stollen, it's enriched bread, And it's studded with candied fruit, peel, there's nuts, there's spices, there's raisins, and they're all soaked in booze. It's a kind of like cross between like a fruit cake and a hot cross bun. That's the best way I could put it. And initially, Stollen was just made of flour and oats and water because during the Advent season, there was no sugar, there was no fruit, there was no booze. Then 100 years later, it evolved to include flour and oil and water and yeast. So it becomes a bit more bready. Now, because Stollen is baked during Advent, the church forbade the use of butter. Okay. Now, five popes later, the elector of Saxony was finally allowed to use butter without paying a fine. And so that's what you have today. So you have a much more decadent kind of bread, again, fruit bread, hot cross bun bread. That's kind of what it is today. And it became a bit richer. Marzipan is used a lot today as well, because this was an Advent dish, a meal recipe. Now, vegan versions of Stollen abound. If you join me in Alsace for Christmas, and you can do so in 2023, we have just released and announced our magical Christmas trip to Alsace, where we also do go to Germany and we go to Switzerland, and we are in the Alsace region, and we have regional seasonal food that we make plant-based with the chefs that we work with. It's kind of a magical time, and it's one of the trips that sells out pretty quickly. So if you'd like to join me for that, I can guarantee you some delicious traditional Stollen suitable for joyful vegans. And of course, we have our other trips that are running as well. We have just one more spot for Tuscany in 2023 also. So that's June 2023. I believe we are sold out of Northern Italy, but we also have our French countryside trip in September, where we start in Paris, we end in Bordeaux. And in between, we're in the Loire Valley, we're in the Dordogne Valley, we're going to be on the rivers. There's more than one river we're going to be on, and we're going to have all manner of fun. So lots of wonderful European trips you can join us for. But if you want this magical Christmas experience, I really encourage you to go to joyfulvegantrips.com and check out the Alsace trip for 2023, December 2023, and you will be home in time for Christmas. It's something that is important to me and probably important to you as well. So you get all of the Christmas revelry and you still get to be home for Christmas. So in part two, I'll call it part two, it's really just another part of this story. Now that we've talked about the fasting, I want to talk about the feasting. And so we're going to talk about the traditional foods that would be part of the 12 days of Christmas, feasting and revelry, and that's coming up next. So I hope you found this interesting or helpful or inspiring or validating or whatever you take away from this. I just really hope you enjoyed it. I would love to hear what your experience is during this period, what your childhood experience has been, and what your current experience is. It's always so interesting to me. For the animals, this is Colleen Patrick-Gaudreau. Thanks for listening, and Merry Christmas.